KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, down by Great America.
Sunset District.
In between Cupertino and Saratoga.
San Jose.
Oakland.
Coming up, cannabis tourism companies roll out in the Bay Area.
We want to put our best foot forward, and yeah, we're just not the bong on a bus group. You know, that's not us.
Then how housing advocates want to target the most exclusive neighborhoods in San Francisco.
When you can't build apartments in all these neighborhoods, they become exclusive, primarily white enclaves. And that's not productive for a city that publicly claims to support inclusion and diversity, but its land use policies promote elitism and lack of diversity.
And an award-winning story from our friends at San Quentin Radio.
Why is it so difficult for me to speak in Vietnamese when, like, I speak it at home?
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. When recreational cannabis went legal in California, cannabis tourism companies started popping up around the state. They offer travelers a chance to smoke and sip wine, paint and puff, and learn cannabis factoids while lighting it up. Tourists are willing to pay a lot of money for the chance to get legally high with other people. KALW's Holly J. McDeed wanted to see what cannabis tourism was all about, so she went for a ride with Emerald Farm Tours.
The cannabis tour bus is no old school hippie van. The people along for the trip pile into a black Mercedes Sprinter, a large, souped-up limo van with tinted windows. We're docked in downtown San Francisco near the Ferry Building.
The rule on this tour is if you see food and want it, let us know. We'll stop for you.
Tour guide Victor Pino passes around a goodie bag full of Laffy Taffys, Skittles, Sun Chips, and water. Victor used to work in marketing. He wants us all to be comfortable and happy. Which is what you'd expect for nearly $150 per person. The tourists dig through the gift bag.
Stop us if you don't understand a term. If at any point you feel uncomfortable, too high, you need something, just let us know. We're here for you guys.
There's only 5 people on this weed tour, counting me. There's cannabis journalist David Bienenstock and a friend he brought along, but they don't want to talk to me. Then there's Don and Mel, a normal-looking couple from Pennsylvania.
Good morning. We're from the Philly area in Pennsylvania.
They don't want me to use their real names. When I ask why, Mel looks at me like I have no human decency. She tells me she has small kids. I get it. Marijuana is illegal in Pennsylvania, and the stigma is real. She and her husband could get in big trouble at work. And we're awkwardly introducing ourselves like it's the first day of summer camp.
And we're just taking a vacation, starting off in San Francisco, visiting some relatives in Berkeley, going to wine country, and then Lake Tahoe.
And spending an entire afternoon on a bus smoking weed with strangers. Up until this year, buying recreational weed was a crime in California. Now even parents and business casual are showing up for cannabis tours.
It's just so new, as you were saying, it's now changing the culture of cities and other places. It's just kind of how the whole thing came about, how it's changing San Fran.
As the Mercedes winds through San Fran, Victor chirps out cannabis cultural history factoids. He's like that kid playing a car game where you shout out everything you see. The twist is everything he sees is connected somehow to weed. He points out Golden Gate Park.
To the cannabis industry specifically, there's 2 things to take away from it. There's Hippie Hill.
Sometimes there is no connection, like when Victor explains Beard Papa Cream Puffs.
It's a Japanese company, and the whole thing is they have 3 things, like 3 kinds of cream puff, vanilla, chocolate, and like the special flavor of the day. And the whole thing
Victor is a good talker, and the tourists nod along, intrigued. Victor has hosted these tours since he launched Emerald Farm Tours in February. The idea came to him while he was showing a friend around cannabis farms in Humboldt County.
And on the way back, he was like, hey, you should really consider doing this for a living. This is something you do really well. Well, I guess, one part knowledge, one part, experience, and one part charisma.
Now this is Victor's full-time gig. Since weed went legal, other tourism-related companies have popped up in Northern California. There are herb-friendly retreats called Bud and Breakfast, behind-the-scene tours through dispensaries. weed and wine combo tours in Mendocino County.
We're really into being good ambassadors and good stewards to our own industry and community, and we want to put our best foot forward, and yeah, we're just not the bong on a bus group, you know, that's not us.
Just for the record, smoking cannabis in a vehicle is illegal in California. Everyone partakes only at stops, and there's a driver who doesn't inhale at all. Victor says he wants to share marijuana history with people who visit from places where marijuana is strictly illegal. Then maybe people like the Pennsylvania couple can spread the joys of cannabis back home.
Hey, Victor.
Yes?
Can you crank the music a couple knots up? Part of the experience.
We pass by the Grateful Dead House in Haight-Ashbury. The mamas, you know, and the papas play in the background.
Not even ironic, it's coincidental, that 710 Ashbury is the Grateful Dead House, and it also is oil upside down.
Victor doesn't shy away from talking about California's fraught relationship to cannabis. The war on drugs, the reefer madness, the arrests, and the rebels. Like Brownie Mary, a San Francisco General Hospital volunteer who baked cannabis brownies for AIDS patients in the 1980s. She was arrested 3 times for distributing marijuana.
She's a legend, and, we need more strong little old ladies selling weed.
All this history brings us to the present, where things aren't going so well. We stop at Spark, a cannabis dispensary on Mission Street. The bud tender says all the new regulations that went into effect when marijuana was legalized in California are bringing her down.
We don't even have any of our farm direct stuff. Wow. Everything's gone.
Victor attempts to explain all this to Don and Mel. He says big weed corporations are pushing small pot businesses out.
The playing board on which we were playing, they took the board and just flipped the pieces, like flipped the whole board. Nothing landed in place. Like everything is all over the place. So as you guys move forward in Pennsylvania, make sure this doesn't happen.
Don and Mel both say cannabis legalization is inevitable, even in their home state of Pennsylvania. That's where the cannabis industry is going, to where it's normal for responsible, upstanding suburbanites with kids to talk openly about smoking cannabis.
And a mild user of smoking, probably, you know.
Predominantly.
Yeah, so, yeah, once a month. So learning about the other ways of products.
We're going to have a little bit of unstructured time. If you guys want to consume, we're going to happy to let you guys consume and walk you through that process.
We step out of the Mercedes van and search for a quiet spot at Golden Gate Park by some trees.
Hey, we were, but we're up. We're exploring, guys.
Cool.
Why not? As long as you can keep walking up the hill.
Victor describes this part of the tour as the cannabis confessional. Spot. It's where the guests talk about the first time they smoked and all the highs and lows since. He passes out a joint of his homegrown Castro Valley cannabis.
But the OG varietal has a very gassy flavor. Most OGs smell a little bit like diesel fumes a little bit. But ultimately, it's a very mellow, very equally balanced smoke. What I'd recommend is if you're not a regular consumer, take a hit, pass it along, wait a few minutes before it comes back around.
Victor talks a lot, like an older friend who likes to initiate people into the tribe.
I'm a champion cougher. I win gold medals in coughing.
Everyone here seems to be genuinely enjoying themselves and getting comfortable. I get the sense that the tourists here are in search of intimacy as much as Bud. A more personal experience of a new place, something beyond the usual scenic sights. And what could be more intimate than sharing someone's homegrown bud and bad jokes?
I mean, I just want to make sure no one breaks face. I have an insurance policy, but not a good one. No, I'm just kidding. That's a bad insurance joke. I used to work in insurance, so I know all the bad insurance jokes.
Mel tells us her husband didn't even tell her they were going on a cannabis tour. I'm not sure if this is a joke. She seems happy anyway. With a joint in her hand, she opens up, even asking the cannabis farmer for gardening tips.
You can't plant like 2 seeds of corn and expect a healthy crop because they need to.
The female actually stresses out and creates better and more THC in its absence of male pollen. So with the presence of male, metaphor for life, exactly, right?
After the tourists are done smoking, we hop back into the Mercedes. From there, it's all a blur, but at some point, I think there are bison.
Another enclosure there. See them all in the distance there?
Yeah.
That's the bison breeding program.
Everything about this feels surreal and wacky. They say traveling is about broadening your horizons, seeing bison and windmills, for example, and finding common ground, sharing homegrown bud and gardening tips with a new friend. In that sense, this cannabis tour delivers. You'll just need $149. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Holly is KALW's justice reporter. You can reach her at justice@KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. There are a lot of things to blame for the housing affordability crisis in the Bay Area. We talk about a shortage of housing. We talk about predatory landlords and property flippers. We talk about why we have a for-profit housing system at all. In his new book, longtime San Francisco housing activist Randy Shaw implicates a particular group who've profited from this affordability crisis. That's urban homeowners. The book is called Generation Priced Out: Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? Randy's research was based in New York, Seattle, Denver, Austin, LA, and here in San Francisco, where he runs the Tenderloin Housing Clinic and the news site beyondcron.org. KALW's economy reporter Liza Veal spoke to Shaw about how he sees the role of homeowners in the story of urban unaffordability.
People might be surprised to learn that cities like San Francisco, which are very seen as very pro-tenant, over half the available residential land, you cannot build a new apartment building. When you can't build apartments in all these neighborhoods, they become exclusive, primarily white enclaves, and that's not productive for a city that publicly claims to support inclusion and diversity, but its land use policies promote elitism and lack of diversity.
And how have homeowners kind of been a part of making those circumstances?
Well, the homeowners, first, they have political influence with elected officials through district elections in San Francisco. And also, very critically, when it comes to these land use hearings that occur at 2 o'clock on Thursday at the Planning Commission, who can go to a hearing? It's often the homeowners turn out in force, and the officials feel, well, gee, we're hearing from the community, but actually they're hearing from a sliver. And as I discuss in the book, in city after city, homeowner associations are considered demographically unrepresentative, even their own neighborhood. They're wider and more homeowner-based than the rest of their neighborhood.
Homeowners object to new apartments because they're worried about preserving the character. Is there more, like, kind of financial stake that they have?
Well, I think, I mean, they're making great profits by restricting supply, but I think they would say, I mean, they don't want apartments in their neighborhood. They want fewer people. They feel like there's more parking spots. I mean, meanwhile, they're exporting the housing problem to suburban locales, which lead to great traffic problems and greenhouse gas emissions from these long commutes we have in the Bay Area. So I think they have this out of sight, out of mind, like, okay, we're going to keep our neighborhood pristine and keep no cars on the street. And the fact that 120,000 people are commuting from Sacramento to the Bay Area every day, we don't see that, so we're going to make believe it doesn't exist. It's hard to see. If we were creating a policy right now in San Francisco, there is no way in the world city government or any supervisor would say, we should take half the city and only let homeowners live there. There's just no way that would be the case. Same thing with Oakland, the fact that you have Rock Ridge and Temescal and these areas that are high transit corridors that have a 30-foot height limit. Like, why?
Okay, so you describe in the book some real ways in which renters' interests are at odds with the interests of homeowners. When we prioritize renters' interests, it entails undermining the value of homes. And
I would challenge that, though. I think every study has shown that even affordable housing in homeowner areas does not reduce home values. No, it doesn't reduce the value of homes. I mean, that's what's so unfair about it, is that the notion that if you have, like it's just happened in San Jose, housing for teachers, 4,000 people signed petitions saying it's going to reduce our property values. Totally false.
But if we do overall build enough housing supply to make the value of housing go down, then housing as an investment will be less profitable.
Well, right now, the last 6 years, homeowners in San Francisco made $1 million profit. So, I mean, the profits have been astronomical, far beyond. Most people don't buy a house for their own private house. They buy it because they like a residence. They want security. They're not trying to get $60,000 a year in equity going up every year.
Yeah, that's a real scenario. But there's also, I mean, it is one of the important ways that people in this country secure their economic futures. It's an investment that you can cash in retirement. It's a way to bring your family, your children into a different economic bracket than you were in. It's an advantage that is not just for very rich people.
Are you saying that, yeah, the boomer homeowners who bought in the 80s obviously didn't pay a lot for their houses and they've made a profit. Are you saying that they should continue to make humongous profits at the expense of a new generation who can't afford to live in the city? I guess I wouldn't agree with you on that.
No, I wouldn't either, but I'm just wondering if there are, you know, if there's a certain tension that you do have to grapple with between lower income homeowners who are betting on that.
I think that's a myth of the lower income homeowner, and I don't think it's really a myth.
I mean, in East Oakland and Richmond, there are lower income.
Well, I'm not talking about Richmond in my book, but I think the question is, what if you want to live in, if you're a teacher, and you teach in San Francisco, should you have to live in Richmond because you can't afford San Francisco? I think San Francisco should provide you opportunities. That's what I believe. That's what the book argues.
So you're saying you don't worry about how any of these things could come at the expense of this?
I don't think it's at the expense. I don't think maximizing profits of homeowners should be a social goal when you mean excluding teachers, nurses, firefighters, and other working people from living in a city.
Okay, so you have a lot of respect for some of these activists that are trying to, the predominantly millennial activists that are trying to change this. People refer to them as YIMBYs sometimes, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. And they're pushing for upzoning neighborhoods or legalizing apartments. You say they're talented. What are they doing right? What kinds of things do you think they're doing wrong in your mind?
Well, I think they're turning out. In these cities like Cupertino, which never allowed any tech facilities, they didn't have any housing connected to it, and that helped really hurt San Francisco. They go out to Cupertino, the YIMBYs, and they've been very good at getting housing approved there. I think that the legalizing apartments campaign is really critical because I think it highlights the key issue. Because when you use the word upzoning, no one really is quite clear what it means. They think, oh, wait, you're going to put high rises in the west side of San Francisco? Or you're going to put high rises in Rock Ridges? No, we can keep the same height, but instead of a mansion, you can build a fourplex. And that's really the key issue that I don't think people realize is that the Sunset is zoned 40 feet and you can build a mansion. A 40-foot tall mansion. You cannot build 4 units or 10 units. That makes no sense. And I think you're going to see the supervisors recognize that, and it makes it harder to vote against something when you say you want a mansion rather than a fourplex.
The critique that I hear against people that focus as their main priority, you know, density and promoting private development in cities is that these people can be sort of neglectful of some of the drawbacks, which are basically displacement.
I think that way too much is made out of there's a whole universe of people who support housing. Many of them, some people don't have the same views as I do on this issue. They oppose rent control. You obviously have to have rent control. But I think across the board, what the main thrust is going on is saying we have to legalize apartments in single-family home neighborhoods or we're never going to get out of this housing crisis. I think if you look, and I write in the book about the Mission District, which has been seen like ground zero in the gentrification wars, one of the reasons so much housing, multi-unit buildings get proposed for the Mission is they can't build in half the city. So you're limiting where you can build to the Mission and Soma and Tenderloin neighborhoods because vast stretches of the city you can't build apartments. If we change that, it would be less displacement.
Okay, so last I wanted to ask you about, just in light of these fires, how housing can or must play a role in fighting climate change and also preparing the state for
it. This is the whole issue that unlike in Seattle and in other cities, Portland, there's a high environmental consciousness realizing we have to have infill housing. Otherwise, we have sprawl, which is the worst form for greenhouse gases. But in places like Berkeley, you have homeowners who drive a Prius, recycle, maybe have solar panels on their roof, but then prevent any apartments being built in their neighborhood, consigning a whole group of people who could be living in Berkeley to Sacramento and making hour-long commutes. The greenhouse gases created by those 120,000 commuters coming from Sacramento to the Bay Area every day is humongous. And that's really the problem.
That was Randy Shaw speaking with Liza Veal about his new book, Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? You can find more from Shaw at beyondcron.org, and you can reach Liza at economy@klw.org. This is Cross Currents, and now we want to do a little bragging. Not for ourselves, but for some deserving people we work with. The incarcerated men at San Quentin State Prison who make San Quentin Radio. Five of them were honored earlier this month for best feature reporting by the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California. So we thought we'd play one of those pieces for you right now.
San Quentin Radio. Bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you gotta own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free, I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
Imagine if you forgot how to speak the language you learned as a child, a language that gave you an identity, a language that says, hey, you belong here, you're one of us. How will your sense of self be impacted? San Quentin Radio's Anutin Pangtong sits down with an incarcerated man as he shared his story.
Tên của tôi là David Bum Lê. Năm nay tôi 33 tuổi. Tôi ở trong tù cũng hơn 10 năm rồi. My name is David Lê. I'm 33 years old, and I've been incarcerated for about over 10 years. My ethnic background is Vietnamese American. Vietnamese as a language is part of who I am, and I can't take away or do without it, you know, because I'll be losing a piece of myself. My language ties into my culture and my identity in a way where if you look at me, right, if I'm telling you that I'm American, clearly there's something wrong because I do not look American. I look Asian, Vietnamese. I don't remember speaking Vietnamese as well was when I think I was in middle school, starting middle school. At that time, I met some of my Vietnamese peers, and to me, like they seem to me, they speak Vietnamese very fluently, and I try to converse with them in Vietnamese, but I find it very difficult. I can't like find the word to express myself, but I can do it in English. And so I've kind of questioned myself, like, why is it so difficult for me to speak in Vietnamese when like I speak it at home? Being incarcerated with the progression of losing like my Vietnamese language is like there's not a lot of compared to other races in prison, there's not a lot of Vietnamese. It's like less than 1% compared to the whole general population. And so it's like everywhere you go, there's some other ethnicity or some other race that's not Vietnamese. So it's kind of hard to find like my peers, like my Vietnamese peers, just to actually just try to communicate and just talk about things in Vietnamese. So it's very difficult. And if I don't find anybody to talk to, I'll slowly lose it. I like to say like programs that like allow us to learn about our culture and not just the Vietnamese culture, but all culture. Those programs are rich for our own personal development. And without those programs, I mean, I think we're losing a part of ourselves. In a sense, we're losing history.
That story was produced by Anutin Pangtong. Our radio training program at San Quentin State Prison is supported by the California Arts Council with funding from the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. And a quick note, Anutin was incarcerated at the age of 15, and after spending more than two decades behind bars, he was paroled earlier this year. When this story was honored with others from San Quentin Radio by the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California this month, Anutin was able to accept the award in person, and he got a standing ovation. You can see that. Find a link to the video at klw.org. Today's team includes Janae Darden, Joanne DeLuna, Angela Johnston, Sarah Nora Coast, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Eli Wertschafter, and Aliyah Yates. Gabe Graben, Tariq Foda, and James Rollins engineer the show. Shirin Adil is our content manager. David Boyer is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.